I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace,
James,
Nick,
Mersham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau,
Christopher, Michael,
Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Saadade 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, noted analyst Muin Rabbani took some time out of his extremely, extremely busy schedule to have a 35-minute or so conversation with me about a number of topics related to the Israeli assault on Gaza and issues related to Israel-Palestine, including Israel and the International Criminal Court, Israel's AI war machine, Mahmoud Abbas as an obstacle to Palestinian unity, the regional dynamics of the Gaza war, and the motivations of Hamas on October 7th, achieving a long-term resolution in relation to the Israel-Palestine conflict, and much, much more. So, with that in mind, let's get right to it with Muin Rabbani.
Welcome to Parallax Views. The guest that I'm very happy to be speaking with is an editor at Jedalia and a really great analyst on all things related to the Middle East, especially Israel-Palestine. How are you doing, Muin Rabbani?
Hi, good to be with you.
So there's a number of things I wanted to discuss with you. I know we're short on time. What do you think the most important things people need to be paying attention to now are with regards to the situation in Gaza and also just more broadly, because I think we also have to keep an eye on the West Bank.
Right. Well, it's a very good question. I think the key issue to understand is that although the current crisis erupted on October 7th of last year, its roots stretch back much further and are not limited to what's been happening in the Gaza Strip, but relates to the whole core of Israeli-Palestinian relations and Israel's continuing dispossession of Palestinians from their land, its continued attempts to reduce the population of these territories, what they call maximum land with minimal Arabs. And it's in that broader context that arguably stretches back over a century, and in the more specific context of Israeli policy towards the Gaza Strip since the beginning of this century, that this crisis erupted so violently on October 7th. And what we've seen since then is Israel utilizing its response to those attacks to seek to fulfill long-term ambitions, to essentially push the entire Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip out beyond the borders of Mandatory Palestine, and doing so in a manner that has landed it in front of the International Court of Justice on charges of genocide, and now with several leaders being indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Is there anything else you want to add about the latest ICC news? There were some other things I wanted to cover, but I know this is breaking, so we should talk about it probably.
Well, there's a lot to be said about it. I think the key issue is that the International Criminal Court has finally, after years of investigation, or primarily non-investigation, decided to indict two senior Israeli leaders, the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defense, along with three Hamas leaders. So immediately it raises a question, in a time of genocide, why does the ICC feel the need to balance it by indicting more Palestinians than Israelis? And secondly, why only the Minister of Defense and the Prime Minister? What about the Chief of Staff? What about the various military commanders who are directly involved in these war crimes and crimes against humanity? Why was genocide not included among the charges? And perhaps most importantly, this has been an ongoing case for many years. Why did history start on October 7th for the ICC? Why has it not issued arrest warrants for any of the numerous crimes committed between 2014 and 2023, which is a period it's supposed to be investigating? But having said all that, I think this is enormously significant, not only legally, but also politically, because particularly in the realm of Western public opinion that has tended to see Israel through the prism of European history rather than through the prism of Israeli actions, it peels away the edifice. It makes it all the more difficult to see Israel as anything but the state that is committing these international crimes in full view of the entire world.
Something I wanted to discuss with you is what do you make of everything that's been happening with regards to the US reaction to the events that are currently unfolding in Gaza? And what do you make of, now we have Antony Blinken complaining about leaks. It seems like everything's in disarray. And it also seems like, we have Biden talking about wanting to bring back the PA into Gaza. But I don't think that's something Israel was even considering, and I don't even know that that is viable considering how unpopular Mahmoud Abbas is.
Well, I wouldn't so much speak about the U.S. response to what is happening as opposed to U.S. participation in what is happening. It's abundantly clear that Israel is entirely dependent on the United States militarily, politically, diplomatically. That's one thing this crisis has made clear for anyone who still doubted that. And the U.S. has stopped at nothing to support Israel. Has allowed Israel to repeatedly violate what the US itself defines as red lines, has repeatedly allowed, I would say, encouraged Israel to violate not only international law, but even US domestic legislation. And in that context, I think the US can only be seen as an active participant in the events now unfolding in the Middle East. There is one significant difference between Israel and the United States, which is that for the United States, one priority is to prevent the further regionalization of this war. In other words, it would like it to be limited to an Israeli genocidal campaign against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip without it spreading further to involve other parties that could draw the US directly into this crisis. Well, that's already happened. The US is already being attacked in Syria and Iraq and bombing targets in Iraq. The US is already militarily engaged in the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea. And the reason for this is that the US may well not want a regionalization of this conflict, but refuses to take any meaningful measures that would prevent this from happening.
I also wanted to ask you about, and I know this is getting afield of some of the things happening on the ground right now, but another thing I notice in a lot of the discourse of the intelligentsia here in the US about Gaza is a lot of this talk about the day after. And in particular, I find it pretty offensive in a lot of ways because it seems like a lot of people are talking about this so-called day after scenario. In terms of, well, how can we manage this, day after scenario? How can we manage the population in a technocratic way? And it seems like a lot of centrists in the US have very little desire to actually care about what happens to Palestinians. It's almost like a lot of the intelligentsia views this as a distraction from issues between the US and China and the US and Russia. And I think Palestinians are really treated as expendable.
Well, they certainly are. But this also gets back to your previous question. I think the day after is very much a US-European project, which is what do we do with the Gaza Strip? And what do we do more broadly with the question of Palestine once Israel has achieved its military objectives in the Gaza Strip? In other words, what type of administration do we put in place? And we've heard all kinds of illusory proposals. From bringing back a completely discredited and disempowered and incapable Palestinian authority to a two-state solution, which is basically smoke and mirrors, pretending there's a political process. But there's a more fundamental difference here is that Israel's day after scenario is exactly what we're seeing on the ground now. Israel does not want Hamas. Israel does not want the Palestinian Authority. Israel wants precisely the kind of chaos that we've seen. Its day after scenario is a Gaza Strip that is so unfit for human habitation that Palestinians who it can't physically expel will feel forced to leave. And my last point would be that it's all well and good to talk about day after scenarios, but if you actually want to implement them, you first have to eliminate those who can stop you. In this case, the Hamas movement in the Gaza Strip. And Israel is insufficiently militarily competent to eradicate Hamas as a military force, meaning that no day after scenario can be implemented over its head. That's another aspect that the Americans and Europeans don't seem to have fully internalized.
I was going to say, I think there's reports, and I think you've even talked about this, of Hamas essentially reappearing in northern Gaza now. So that is more to your point, even.
Yes, you can see it as reappearing, which may well be the case. The other alternative is that they were never dismantled or removed in the first place, and that they basically either fought Israel to a standstill in some of these areas, after which the Israelis withdrew, or they managed to hide sufficiently until the Israeli wave passed. And so this idea that, they were all in northern Gaza, then they were all in Al-Shifa Hospital, then they were all in Khan Yunis, and now they're all in Rafah, is absolute nonsense. They seem to be operating in a very localized, decentralized fashion, and there's very little evidence that these are people who had left or came from another area, but rather military forces that undoubtedly were weakened, but far from sufficiently weakened that they couldn't take control of these areas again.
I also wanted you to be able to speak about the issue of Israeli obstinance when it comes to the Palestinians, whether it's negotiating or trying to get a two-state, because I see a lot of people, especially on the side of the sort of Democratic Party, and I'm not partisan bashing here, saying that the problem is Netanyahu. But then I look at someone like Benny Gantz. And Benny Gantz recently came out and said, he wants a plan where, Israel will still have security forces in Gaza even after this is all said and done, and that there would be, I think he referred to it as an American, European, Arab, Palestinian sort of consortium taking care of the civilians there, instead of, the PA or Hamas. I mean, he doesn't even want the sort of Biden plan of installing the PA, which has its own problems. But a lot of people seem to think that if Netanyahu goes away, these problems go away, and I don't think they do.
Well, one only needs to compare the policies of this Israeli government with its predecessor. And there's really no significant distinction as far as Israeli policy towards the Palestinians are concerned. One can go back further decades. The very idea of the creeping annexation of the occupied territories with a goal to eventually annexing very significant parts of them was a project born under the Labour Party that was being led by Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin. So the idea that there's somehow one nefarious leader whose removal would solve all these issues is absolute nonsense. We're talking here about consistent, stable state policy that goes back decades. And that is a problem. I mean, it's the equivalent of what the US is doing now of sanctioning a small number of individual settlers as if they are the problem and not the government which arms them, which confiscates lands on their behalf and so on, and thinking that that's going to solve the problem. So Netanyahu, I think, is a symptom and a product of the problem rather than the problem itself.
We've mentioned the Palestinian Authority a few times, and I think you've had your own analysis of figures like Abbas. What can you say about your analysis of where the PA is at right now? And does Abbas need to go in order for there to be less divisions amongst Palestinians?
Yes, I don't think the Palestinians can overcome their divisions so long as Mahmoud Abbas remains on the scene. I think he's a consistent obstacle. He's not the only obstacle, but he is the main obstacle. And without his removal, the idea of a regeneration of the Palestinian national movement, the idea of Palestinians overcoming their significant divisions is simply not going to happen. And I think that's also one reason why the West is so invested in his perpetual survival, because he serves their purposes and interests of keeping Palestinians weak, powerless, and divided. I think, particularly during the current crisis, the Palestinian Authority has been reduced to a powerless spectator whose only real actions have been to police its own people on behalf of Israel, its army, and its settlers. And that is an absolute scandal. I mean, it takes the characterization of the Palestinian Authority as a Vichy regime to an entirely new level.
Recently, you were a contributor to the title Deluge: Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. And I was wondering if you could speak to your contribution, which deals with the regional dynamics and also maybe pushing back on some of the analysis claiming that the October 7th attack had to do with destroying Saudi-Israel normalization.
Yes, I mean, I wrote about the regional aspects, and I began by analyzing the position of many pundits and analysts and commentators that for Hamas, seeking to sabotage an Israeli-Saudi normalization agreement was a primary motivation for the attacks of October 7th. And the point I made is, well, first of all, there's nothing in Hamas's public statements that would support that. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen, it just means we've very little evidence for it. Then when you look at this supposed normalization agreement more closely, you see that it's not so much an Israeli-Saudi agreement as an Israeli-Saudi-American agreement in which the key concessions are being made not by Israel and Saudi Arabia to each other, but rather by the United States to Saudi Arabia in the form of a formal security guarantee, security umbrella, and delivery of a nuclear program. And the argument I make is that these were American commitments that require congressional approval, and the chances of such congressional approval actually being adopted are fairly minimal. Secondly, such an agreement would require certain cosmetic gestures by Israel towards the Palestinian Authority, and that these were never going to emerge from the current Israeli government. So the argument I make is that on the one hand, Hamas probably clearly understood that this agreement was not going to be imminently consummated, and therefore it wouldn't have been a significant factor in their calculations. And secondly, they will have also understood that if you look at the existing record of Israeli-Arab normalization agreements, these have never been significantly destabilized by Israeli bloodletting of Palestinians. The Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty of 1979 comfortably survived the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon and Sabra Shatila massacres, and I give other examples to demonstrate that undermining Arab-Israeli normalization through an attack on Israel would not have been a successful strategy, and that therefore we need to look elsewhere to understand Hamas's motivations for its attacks of October 7th.
Can you speak to your analysis of those motivations then?
Well, briefly, I think Hamas was looking at the local, regional, and international situation, seeing a Palestinian question that was increasingly marginalized, that the U.S. Adopted, to which the U.S. adopted a policy of strategic neglect in a situation in which Israel was dealing with the Palestinians solely unilaterally and was encroaching further and further upon Palestinian lands in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and so on, and that Hamas decided also on the basis of its own experience in recent years that on the one hand, it needed to irrevocably shatter the status quo, and on the other hand, that it needed to do something genuinely spectacular in order to achieve that objective. And I think it's in that context that we need to understand both the decision to launch the 7 October attacks and the form those attacks took.
Can you speak a little bit to the way the Arab world is responding to what's happening in Gaza, and maybe with a few examples? I really wanted to talk for a second about Egypt, because I see a lot of these criticisms of Egypt saying, well, why don't they just take in all these Gazans? And I think there's a lot more to it from the Egyptian end. There's a lot of security concerns that they have. Do you want to speak to any of that?
Well, for Egypt, since it signed its peace treaty with Israel in 1979, not taking responsibility for the Gaza Strip, not taking it off Israel's hands, has been a central principle of its national security policy. And Israel, from the Egyptian perspective, has made repeated offers slash attempts to offload the Gaza Strip onto Egypt and making it a problem for Egyptian national security rather than one for Israeli security. And there's also, of course, the historical background of Palestinians being a dispossessed, stateless people, of the Gaza Strip being overwhelmingly populated by refugees who were ethnically cleansed in 1948 and their descendants. And explicit Israeli statements in October of last year that they intended to basically push the entire Palestinian population out of the Gaza Strip and into the desert, to the Sinai desert that is part of Egypt. And Egypt was going to have none of that. And it's in that context that Egypt has said, you know, these Palestinians properly belong in Palestine. And if Israel feels a need to remove them from the Gaza Strip, well, then it can very easily open its own borders And allow these people either permanently back to their original homes or at least temporarily on its territory. And given that Egypt is not part of this conflict, why should it be an Egyptian responsibility to solve Israel's problem?
And other than Egypt, how do you think about what do you make of the way the rest of the region has responded to what's happening?
Well, I think we need to make a distinction here between popular opinion and official policy. If you look at the governments in the region, they're largely U.S. client states that live either in terror of Washington or are consistently seeking to curry favor with Washington, and for the most part are not going to let any support for the Palestinians sour their relationships with either the United States or Israel. But having said that, they're also increasingly aware of the possibilities that this conflict, and particularly its regional expansion, could threaten and undermine their own security and stability. That's the official side of the equation. On the popular side of the equation, there are really unprecedented levels of anger and rage towards not only Israel, but also towards the United States and increasingly towards the West as a whole for allowing this genocide to play out, to basically be live streamed 24/7 for the better part of a year now. And the West not only doing nothing to restrain its Israeli proxy, but actively encouraging it and arming it and giving it diplomatic impunity at the United Nations, and so on. And this is going to have very significant long-term consequences.
Just a few more brief questions here. One in particular, as an analyst and someone that speaks to the issues that Palestinians face, I think a lot of us deal with having to cut through a lot of propaganda and public relations coming from the Israeli side. If you talk about the Nakba, there's some pre-made response saying, "Oh, you're wrong." And the fact that the Israeli archives are basically classified and there's been reclassification is ignored. Or we'll see stories coming out saying, "Oh, the UN have the numbers of, Palestinian dead." And we just saw how that's not true, despite being, pushed by people like Joe Scarborough. So we're dealing with all this. I mean, I'll call it what it is. It's propaganda. How do we cut through it? What is the most important thing when it comes to cutting through the propaganda that we see from the Israeli side of things?
Well, I think the most important part of having the capacity to separate fact from fiction is to be well informed, to read widely from a wide variety of sources. And then you begin to learn, for example, that yes, the New York Times is American Pravda. Yes, the New York Times is largely or completely beholden to Israel and the US government. But the New York Times also employs serious correspondents. And often, you need to read past the headline and the first few paragraphs and read an article all the way to its end. Because the useful information that is not propaganda is often buried towards the very bottom of a story. I have to say that, people who are seeking to inform themselves in 2024 have a real advantage compared to people who were seeking to do so in 1984 or 1954, because there's so much more information available that is available directly from the source rather than being mediated by a state news agency or mainstream media or newspapers or what have you. It is a difficult task. There is not only a lot of propaganda out there, but also a lot of false information and so on. So one also needs to be careful with that. But I think my essential advice would be there is no significant obstacle to being properly informed. It's not that difficult to spend some time learning which sources are reliable, which are not reliable, which are useful, which are useless. And propaganda in and of itself, I think, has a value because it gives you a window into the thinking of those with an agenda. I'm a consumer of Israeli propaganda because it helps me understand what they're seeking to achieve and how they're seeking to achieve it and what mechanisms they're using, because their strategy often is not so much to convince you, but to confuse you. As long as you have doubts rather than certainty in their narrative, that's good enough for them.
Just two more things. I wanted to ask you, because I know it's been covered in the past month by yourself and others, but I haven't covered it nearly as much as I should be. And that's the issue of Israel's AI and how it has, you know, played a role in its war machine during this military operation. Can you speak to the importance of looking into that?
Well, I think, you know, Israel has been using artificial intelligence for targeting. And I think it would be wrong to say that it is using artificial intelligence to identify legitimate military targets. It is using artificial intelligence to phenomenally expand the target banks and to not only locate them, but to target them when they are in their homes with family members, with neighbors, and so on. And so I think any serious examination of Israeli genocide during this war is going to also have to examine how Israel used artificial intelligence, not only to target people, but to target people in a manner that ensured sowing the maximum amount of death and destruction on the civilian population of the Gaza Strip. In other words, it's not seeking to locate these people on the field of battle, but is deliberately waiting for them to get home with their spouses, their children, their neighbors, refugees that they are hosting, and so on, precisely in order to ensure a maximum level of death, and then to be able to turn around and say, well, they're using the civilian population as human shields.
The last thing I wanted to get into here, and I'm almost embarrassed to bring it up because I feel like it shouldn't be the immediate concern right now. I feel like the immediate concern should be like seeing the end of this assault we're seeing happen on Gaza. But a lot of people want to talk about, well, what's the definitive solution in the future? Is it a two-state, a one-state, a confederation? What do you make of these debates? Because a lot of people will throw up their arms and say, oh, it's too complicated. There can't be a solution. And I think that's really foolhardy of people to think that.
Well, obviously, this crisis can be resolved. This entire question can be resolved. And I'm among those who consider a two-state settlement entirely feasible in the narrow sense of, is it something that can be achieved, or have we indeed passed a point of no return where it can no longer be implemented? I won't get into the details here, but envisioning a reality in which Israel is compelled to withdraw to the 1967 boundaries and the territories occupied in 1967 are transformed into a genuinely sovereign, genuinely independent Palestinian state is entirely within the realm of imagination. That's a discussion about feasibility. But I think we also need to have a separate and arguably more important discussion about desirability. In other words, even if a two-state solution remains feasible, can there be sustainable peace in the Middle East as long as this genocidal, irrational apartheid regime that responds to every political challenge only with overwhelming force persists? And we have, I think, analogies from the last century that may help us answer that question. In Europe, I think everyone has agreed that there could not have been the decades of peace after 1945 unless certain regimes on that continent had been dismantled and their key institutions dismantled in Southeast Asia in the 1970s. Were it not for dismantling the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the Democratic Republic of Kampuchea, the Khmer Rouge regime, we could not have had peace in Southeast Asia. Similarly, in Southern Africa, had the white minority regimes of Rhodesia and South Africa and their key institutions not been dismantled, we would not have had the peace that that region currently enjoys. And I think there's a serious discussion needs to be held, and a good argument can be made that one needs to dismantle this genocidal, irrational apartheid regime that reacts to political challenges with extraordinary force as a matter of instinct. If that regime and its key institutions are not dismantled, can there be peace in the Middle East? I suspect not. And just to make clear, I'm making a distinction between the state and its institutions on the one hand and its citizens on the other.
Can you elaborate just briefly on that, those distinctions that you're making and why they're important?
Well, I think, as in South Africa and in other cases, you can dismantle a regime and dismantle its key institutions without either exterminating or forcibly deporting its citizens.
I'm glad you said that because I think it's an important point. Because I don't think that, Israelis are just going to, there's going to be a mass exodus, but I do think the institutions and this current, what Ayin Lustig refers to as the one state reality, I think that can be dismantled.
Yes, and again, we can agree that the establishment of the State of Israel was came about through an illegitimate process, and we can agree on the illegitimacy of the state itself and its policies. But just as you have Europeans in South Africa, about whom the same can be said, dismantling the state that privileged them and of which they were the beneficiaries, cannot and should not translate into the collective punishment of that population, whether through forced expulsion or whatever. But again, there are basically three options: the current one-state reality, a two-state settlement, and an entirely different form of coexistence. And I would argue that only by looking more deeply into that third option can we begin to envision a long-lasting, durable peace in the Middle East.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Muin Rabbani and that you'll consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Later this week, we have a new edition of the Parallax Vlog for Parallax Views Patreon supporters, and hopefully a few other goodies along the way, including an early release or two of upcoming shows. So patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, who makes this show possible. I only have one advertiser, the Mighty Mike Swanson, but otherwise, this show is pretty much entirely listener-funded. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I'm I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.